This is Keeping It Real, and I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Did you know I'm a kidney donor? Today's guest is Jackie Wirse from Donate Life Northwest, and we're going to talk about blood and guts. I'm just kidding, Jackie. Kind of kidding. I'm kidding a little bit. No, seriously, full disclosure, I want to be here today to normalize even just the idea of organ donation. And that's why I invited Jackie on the air today. Thank you for being here, Jackie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, which organs are we talking about?
So when it comes to organ donation, there are 8 organs that a single donor can give. This is including the lungs, right and left lungs, your right and left kidneys, your pancreas, a portion of your intestines, your liver, and your heart.
You know, we take it for granted that we live in the most powerful, amazing country on earth, and we can do anything, but it's really not true. And, I mean, if it was true, then probably tens of thousands of people's lives would be saved every year if every person who needed an organ donor found one. So, how big is the need, Jackie?
Well, the need is absolutely huge. Right now, there are 106,000 people that are on the waiting list for an organ. That's just organs. That's not even talking about the individuals that could need corneas or tissue donations. And these are also life-saving and life-enhancing donations. Of those 106,000 people, I always tell Oregonians, it's like Research Stadium, Autzen Stadium, and the Moda Center being packed. That is 106,000 people. And imagine, every single one of those people has a loved one, has a family, has a community that they're in. And if you're on the organ waiting list, that means that you are experiencing a chronic illness that is seriously impacting your quality of life and, in fact, your ability to live. So this is why organ donation is so necessary, because these 106,000 individuals aren't just sick. They are dying without our generous donations and the help that organ donation and transplantation can give them.
We're talking with Jackie Wirse from Donate Life Northwest. Jackie, so this is the thing that gets me too. And I want to talk about my experience as a kidney donor later in this hour, because it was a wild adventure. And I only did it because of my cousin George, right? Mm-hmm. It was really all about my cousin George, because it's not at all uncommon for people to need an organ donor, but it is considered to be very uncommon for someone to be an organ donor. And what I found, this most surprising thing to me about the whole journey of being an organ donor, was the attitudes towards people who needed the organ. Mm-hmm. And now I'm not going to ask you to talk about negative things, mm-hmm. but I did this about 20 years ago. No ill effects of any kind, no complications, except my cat was really big and my cat wanted to lay on me where my sutures were. No. But some of the people that need an organ are children. Mm-hmm. Some of them are babies. You know, there's teenagers, there's elderly people. Talk a little about who are the people who need a donor.
So the people that are on the waiting list come from all walks of life. And as you pointed out, they can be any age. There are infants that are born with cardiac defects that will need an aortic valve immediately. There are individuals that just don't have working kidneys right from the get-go. You can develop catastrophic liver failure for a variety of diseases at any stage of life. So becoming an individual who needs this kind of medical assistance can really happen to anyone. However, having said that, organ donation and transplantation is really the result of a lot of chronic illnesses. And when we talk about chronic illnesses, we have to talk about the systemic determinants of health and racism in the American healthcare system. And when we're talking about that, one of the stark facts that we really need to think about is the fact that multicultural communities make up 40% of the adult American population, but they make up 60% of the people on the wait list. Black Americans are 3 times more likely than the white American counterparts to need a kidney transplant, but yet they wait longer on the kidney transplant to receive those transplants. Now, there's a lot of factors that go into that. It's a super complex conversation, but that's one of the reasons why I'm super excited to be here, is because we need to have these conversations. We can't get our information about what organ donation and transplantation looks like from Grey's Anatomy. That is a really overly good-looking representation of medicine that may or may not actually be really following any kind of rules or regulations. And there are a lot of rules and regulations in place to make this a safe, really, really helpful procedure and one that will save lives. But with any kind of complex medical procedure, there's so many things behind the scenes that make a fuller story.
And we'll talk about this a little bit later. The system is changing a little bit too. And I want to talk about that in a second. But first, I want to say one of my dearest friends, and it's totally okay to cry. One of my dearest friends, his beautiful wife died on the list. I know so many specifically African American people who've died on the list, right? Mm-hmm. Jackie, talk about the list. Is there only one list? Is it a universal list? Mm-hmm. The kidney transplant list that everybody needs to get on. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, so the list is a national donation transplantation match list that is maintained by a federal contracting entity known as UNOS. Getting on the list is not an easy thing. You have to have a medical history. You have to have all of the work done to show that you are a viable candidate for organ donation and transplantation. And you actually have to meet a whole bunch of medical criteria so that when you are on the list, they can identify an appropriate match. So there's a lengthy process of testing and going through conversations with your healthcare team. It's not just your nephrologist. It is social workers. It is nurses. It's dialysis clinics. It is your family, because this is a huge impact on an entire family. So these kinds of conversations and information are what gets put into the national matching system. And the national matching system uses complex algorithms to try and identify the best possible match for medical outcomes. Now, algorithmic bias is something that just exists in this day and age. And this is something that the UNOS system has been working to make sure that they are trying to eliminate algorithmic bias. So for example, for years and years and years, there used to be a race-based calculation that went into the kidney match numbers. And it had to do with estimated glomerular filtration rate and eGFR. So this was based off of a research paper that was performed quite a long time ago and was never properly replicated. And that information got put into, with good faith, they thought it was going to help the calculations, but was subsequently shown to not be helpful. It took a lot of conversation to get that race-based factor removed because it disadvantaged Black Americans. That algorithmic change has been made, but there are always more that need to be identified. It's complex when it comes to matching for organ donation. Not only do you have to have the blood type match, you actually have to have molecular marker matches at a molecular level, and there's 150 plus different types of molecular markers that they're trying to find the best match for. In addition to that, we have geography. The lifetime of an organ, once it has been gathered from a donor, is really quite short. So kidneys have the longest lifespan. They can exist outside of a body in a very specialized pump for up to 30 odd hours. So they can travel across the United States if necessary. However, if we're talking about lungs, lungs are extremely fragile. And once they have been donated, have a lifetime of 3 to 4 hours. So let's think about this. If you are requiring a lung transplant and you live in Burns, Oregon, first of all, there is not a hospital that's going to be able to do the quantitative assessment to get you on the list in Burns. So you're going to have to come to the Portland metropolitan area. Once you get here, then you're going to have all of those assessments done. But if you qualify for the lung transplant program, the closest transplant centers are in Seattle or in California. So if you get a call that there is a lung available, you have to be in Seattle or California. That's because the lifetime of that organ is so short. So I was fortunate enough to witness a donation event that happened in Portland, Oregon. and the individual was able to donate both lungs, both kidneys, and a liver. There were three separate surgical teams that were there and were literally timing things to the minute so that the surgeons could take the organs and fly immediately to Seattle. I think one went to Boise, one went to California in order to do those transplant surgeries. But it was timed to the minute because every minute counts.
And this is a really good time to explain how the United Network for Organ Sharing system works and what people are trying to do to shift it, to try to make it better. I mean, yeah. There have been a lot of criticisms. And if you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We're talking with Jackie
Wurz,
right. I'm looking at all my notes. I have too many notes, and I've got about 30 tabs open. Jackie Wurz is the executive director of Donate Life Northwest, and she's here talking with us. Talk about the critiques of the United Network for Organ Sharing, UNOS, and how it's shifting. I think in March, just a couple of months ago, I think it was, is it operated by the federal government? Announcing that it's going to be evolved a little bit.
Yeah.
Who runs it?
So UNOS is an independent nonprofit that is contracted by the U.S. government and is overseen by HRSA, by the Healthcare Research Administration for Medicaid and Medicare.
That was good. That was good.
So the really complex story behind how UNOS came to be goes all the way back to the very early days of transplant. So in the very early days of transplant...
Is that in the 1980s?
No, 1960s.
Oh my goodness, we tried a long time before we got it right.
Oh yes, it took a long time. So in the 1960s, there were individual hospitals that started pioneering kidney and then eventually liver and lung transplants and heart transplants as technology improved. So during these times, these places would have their own networks of trying to identify donors and recipients. As the procedures became more common, as more and more surgeons were trained, then eventually they started developing regional networks. At this point, because there were so many concerns of, is this fair, how we're distributing this gift of life, is Are we distributing these unfairly to really, really famous individuals or super, super wealthy individuals? There was a lot of ethical discussions going on at the time. So at this point, the United States government stepped in and said, hey, look, we're going to create a national system that is going to have federal oversight that will create the infrastructure that all transplant centers in the United States are going to use to find appropriate matches. And that's where UNOS came in. So they developed this rule in the federal government level, and then UNOS was the single contractor that bid on this contract, and they have held that contract since the 80s. Now, the controversy that comes in today is the fact that UNOS has been the only person to hold this contract. And there has been concerns about the quality of the technology that underpins the software that's used for the matching and how the matches are actually tracked both pre-match, during the actual donation and transplantation event, and then post-transplantation outcomes. So there's a lot of questions that people have been asking and really trying to think very thoughtfully about, are we investing our federal dollars in a way that is going to save as many lives as possible? Mm-hmm. Now, there were investigations that were instigated by a couple of different parties, but most notably, Ron Wyden, Senator Wyden, here from the state of Oregon, is the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. Now, the Senate Finance Committee chose to look into UNOS, into the system of transplantation, because they were concerned about inefficiencies in the system. Now, we've all heard about inefficiencies in the government system.
For real.
Yeah, like $200 hammers and all that good stuff. But in this case, an inefficiency in the system could mean that we're losing lives. So this is why Senator Wyden really wanted to take a deeper dive. In his investigation, they gathered information about the organ procurement organizations, and there are 56 different licensed organ procurement organizations across the nation, and how they work, and then also how UNOS works to make all the matches and then make sure that the transplantation network continues moving forward. So in the course of the investigation, the concerns about technology, about algorithmic bias, about the transparency of the system were all brought up. And this resulted in a couple of different major actions. So under President Trump, he proposed a comprehensive proposal to specifically advance kidney health, but also it addressed UNOS by calling for reform of that particular organization. And then recently, Biden formalized that by investing into a Modernization Act for organ donation and transplantation. He doubled the amount of dollars that are going into the system to provide a comprehensive analysis of it, and then also is expanding the opportunity for people to bid for that contract. So this is going to be a really interesting time because we're going to see new players come and have different ideas about how we can set up this essential life-saving network.
If I understand it correctly, too, and just to boil it down to super simple ideas, part of what's difficult about it is that people all over the country may need a transplanted organ of whatever kind it is, but there aren't the facilities to make that happen where the patients are. So the question is how to bring the rapidly expiring organs to where they're needed, and mm-hmm. that right there is the most difficult thing. If I understand it correctly.
I think every part of this thing is very, very difficult. So when you have to identify a donor, you also have to weigh geography. So the amount of time it's going to take for the organ to get to the transplant site, but also the amount of time that individual is going to take to get to the center and be prepped in time. There was a rule that said that you couldn't donate outside of a given organ procurement organization's zone. But then they changed that rule. They changed it to being within 150 nautical miles because that way rural people would have better access to whatever organs might be available to save lives. So things like that are, you can see how they developed in the originally, this organ procurement organization, they cover this region. But when you look at the side of their region, actually there's this other place that's actually closer. And now that they've done the 150 nautical mile rule, now they can have a higher chance of receiving an organ from a place that's actually geographically closer, even if it's in a, quote, separate district. So these are so many complex considerations. And then there's like the transportation issue. How are you going to get these life-saving organs there efficiently and effectively? And one of the major concerns in that Senate finance hearing was the loss of a couple of organs in transit. And to lose a piece of luggage is bad enough, but to lose the kidney that's going to save your child's life, that is devastating. So there have been documented instances of organ loss during transport. Now, overall, if you look at the size of the system and the frequency, it is not as bad as, shipping in first class mail, but that doesn't excuse the fact that any loss is catastrophic. So there are some very basic questions that were asked. If I can put an AirPod and know exactly where my package is going on my own, and if I'm shipping a crate of straws to my sister-in-law, why can't I do that for a kidney, right? So the transportation issue, part of it is tracking, and we have the sophistication and technology in this country to do amazing tracking. Amazon knows way too much, and I get photos all along the way of where my package is. So being able to apply that technology to the life-saving nature of donation and transplantation, that is a real big question that people are saying, let's make sure this can happen.
I mean, the goal being, like, can we just hook up everyone that needs an organ with the organ they need? Like, it seems like such a simple goal, but it seems also all at the same time almost impossible to do that.
It is the goal and the mission of Donate Life Northwest is a vision for a world where no one has to wait for an organ. Right now, the wait times vary based off of organ. So, for example, the average wait time for a kidney in the United States is 5 years. That is 5 years of dialysis. Every dialysis session is taking a day out of your life. And most people that are on dialysis on the wait list are taking 3, 4, even 5 days a week of dialysis. So this is not a way to live your life. One thing that we also need to acknowledge is that in order for us to be able to eliminate the 106,000 person wait list, is that we need to have more and more registered donors. Right now, in the state of Oregon, we're actually number 7 in the nation for the percentage of people who are registered to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor.
I'm very surprised.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Oregon has actually been really pioneering. We were the first state in the nation to have a DMV ask you if you would be an organ, eye, or tissue donor. Now we take it for granted. I think it even made it into an SNL skit that a DMV is going to ask you this question. But Oregon was the very first. And our registry has gone from 0 to 3 million registered Oregonians. And that is a beautiful gift. However, of the 44,000 Oregonians that passed away in 2022, less than 200 of them were eligible to become an organ donor because you must pass away under very specific circumstances. Now, many, many more of those individuals were able to go on to be cornea and tissue donors. But for living, for organ donation, it was something a smidge under 200 were actually able to donate in 2022. And that's because your organs still have to be receiving oxygen. You have to have perfused organs. And there has to have stable body chemistry and then also identify a viable match.
We're speaking with Jackie Wurz of Donate Northwest. We're talking about organ donation across the country, organ donation in Oregon. Jackie, what does Donate Life Northwest do?
Donate Life Northwest is Oregon and Southwest Washington's nonprofit that promotes organ, eye, and tissue donation through education, advocacy, and outreach. So on the education side of things, we speak at schools. We have a volunteer educator program where our volunteer educators will go into this last year, 151 different schools, tell their personal stories about their connections to donation, and then provide information so that students have the information necessary to make an informed conversation and hopefully an informed decision. Now, this is something we're really excited about. In 2025, it's actually going to be required education for all high school students in the state of Oregon that are taking public health classes to receive information about organ, eye, and tissue donation. So that's one part of our education outreach program. We have a community outreach program where we go into community fairs, we go to faith-based centers, we go to community-based organizations and just provide information and awareness about organ, eye, and tissue donation and speak to the impacts that organ, eye, and tissue donation have. And then we have our advocacy. So we are always advocating on behalf of organ, eye, and tissue donation. If there is legislation that's coming up before the state of Oregon, we are always making sure that it is something that aligns with the mission of making more donors and making the system more efficient and equitable. That's the advocacy that we do to make sure that Oregon continues to be a leader in this space.
Shout out to my friend Shannon Olive, whose dad Bobby was the first heart donator in the history of Oregon, and Dr. Albert Starr, who's actually super famous.
Yeah.
He actually did the operation, and I've heard Shannon and her mom tell the story about a lot of African American people don't feel comfortable donating organs. I think that probably a lot of that has to do with racial profiling in the hospital. We don't talk enough about the racial profiling that happens at the hospital, but Bobby had been shot. And the doctors literally said, we have this thing we're set up to do. We're set up, believe it or not, to transplant a heart. And your son, talking to Shannon's grandmother, your son could be the first person to be a part of this. And Shannon tells a story about how her grandma went into a room by herself and she prayed and she said God told her that Bobby's heart needed to go to this old white man, right? Like so often there's a lot of... I just, as saying as a donor for all these years, I'm always surprised at the emotional baggage we bring, but I get it, right? And one of the things that Shannon talks about is why it made a big difference that her father was African American and that he actually benefited someone who maybe was not a racial champion of his own, but it was just something that they felt was important to do. Yeah. And Shannon, you're so cool. I had to say that to Shannon.
So you are absolutely correct. The Black community sometimes has deep intrinsic distrust of the medical establishment. I mean, this goes back hundreds of years, but like relatively recently, you look at the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. I mean, it is horrific. And if your community has been targeted in an unethical way, then why would you feel trust going into a hospital or a scary situation? So that's one of the things that really we need to work with, is this distrust of the medical establishment and a growing distrust of scientific experts. So that makes it difficult to really speak to the impact of donation and transplantation sometimes, because we are talking with individuals that intrinsically don't want to hear from physicians. They are concerned with health, but they don't want to have more stats and journal articles from academics touted in their face. They want to understand the real true community impact. And Bobby is a great example. This young man whose heart and kidney want to live on. And one of my favorite things about Bobby's story is Belinda Olive Beltran,
his sister.
His sister has been a staunch advocate for donation and transplantation, and she has become friends with the recipients' families. We have this program called the Threads of Life Quilt, and each quilt square is submitted by a donor or a recipient or a family member. And Belinda submitted a square honoring the recipient's mother, because she had grown close to this individual. The woman passed away after 102 years of life, and Belinda wanted to honor that on the quilt. That is the type of life and connections and community that transplantation can create.
Bobby Olive donated his heart in 1985, I think.
Yes.
So this issue of race and the donations, it keeps coming back and coming back. But the part that hurts me is how many African-American people I see who have not risen to the top of that list. Mm-hmm. And I've helped a couple people try to get donors. Hassan Arthur Ree, he was successful in getting a donor. And it took 50,000 people to look at my Facebook post before someone, and only two people stepped up to be tested. Mm-hmm. And one of those people was compatible. But Jackie, let's walk this back a little bit. People can be a live donor, mm-hmm. or they can make arrangements for when they pass away. Talk about that. Talk about the difference between the two. What are those options?
Yeah. So when you're signing up at the DMV to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor, that is as a deceased donor. So when individuals pass away, the professionals that are involved with funeral arrangements or those types of arrangements, they will check the registry to see if an individual is able to donate eye or tissue. If you pass away in a hospital in the ICU under conditions that are amenable to donation of organs, then there's donation professionals will check the registry at that point in time. But that's less than 1% of all hospital admissions are resulting in an eligible donation event. So because deceased donation is actually relatively rare, living donation is something that is growing in impact. Living donation is where you can donate a kidney, a portion of your liver, a portion of your lung, or a portion of your intestines to an individual, and you will undergo the procedure and you will be perfectly fine afterwards. So living donation is truly giving the gift of life. And before the living donation event occurs, you go through a lot of medical screening to make sure that you will have a normal quality of life. And the health outcomes research for this has shown time after time that the quality of life that you will live a long and healthy life. So I myself actually am in the second stage of testing to become a living liver donor.
Wow. That's exciting.
That's
exciting. I have to say, so I was a donor, I think it was in 2003, 2004. I want to share my cousin George's journey. George Harmon was my cousin. He was a person whose career, he helped people with disabilities. He was from the central San Joaquin Valley, right? Mm-hmm. So lived in Sacramento. Whoa, it's hot. Anyway, when he realized he had health problems his entire life, like he was born diabetic and, mm-hmm. you know, and his whole family, and they had very specific health problems that they had to have injections and other issues as well. So his whole life, he had health problems. And he always volunteered to be the person who would try the experimental thing. He loved that. What a guy. He also was a very deep Christian. His spirituality had a lot to do with every aspect of his life. I personally am not a Christian, but I could completely respect that. Just wanted to put that on the table too. But one night, George called me and he told me that he needed a kidney donor. And I was like, George, like, I don't even think that we voted for the same guy for president and you want something from me? Like, doesn't it matter who you voted for president and why you want my what now? Mm-hmm. And we talked about it. I'm kind of an airheaded person. If you know me, you know it's true. So I get excited about it. I never, it was easy for me to say, yeah, sure, I'm going to go through all the tests because you have to go through kind of a lot of tests.
Yep.
And so I went through the initial tests and it was like, sure, you can, yeah, Lisa, you're still in the running for this job. Keep taking more tests. And I was so excited about it. Okay. And I took some more tests and finally I went to Kaiser and they were like, this is it. These are the last tests. The people at Kaiser, I struggle with Kaiser a lot, but the people there that did all these tests, there literally were 10 or 12. They were so excited to be working with someone who wasn't sick. Mm-hmm. And when they found out what I was there for, they were even more excited because that sounded crazier than anything that they do all the time. So there was a lot of camaraderie, believe it or not. There was blood, there was needles, and there was camaraderie. But I've never been a person that was afraid of blood or needles. So when the time came, I got this call from my doctor and he said, Lisa, we can't find any reason why you can't be a donor. And that's when it hit me what I had signed up to do. Like, oh my God, but we were just taking tests though. What is this about? What am I agreeing to do? I come from a really close family. My mom is a nurse. She's a nerdly nurse. Mm-hmm. And she got kind of excited about the science, but she also thought there were people in my life who told me not to do it. Mm. I'm going to be honest, really super duper honest right now. Mm-hmm. And every one of those people offended my intelligence. And that's probably part of the reason I went through with it. And that's me. That's my brain. Oh, this person thinks I shouldn't do that. Well, I'm hella going to do it now. Mm-hmm. The thing is, I had zero complications. I was never going to wear a bikini again anyway, putting that out. But, you know, a lot of people are interested in the scars. People love scars. But at the end, there were no complications. I felt good about it, and I still feel good about it. My cousin George's goal in life was to attend his daughter's high school graduation.
Yeah.
He only lived another 4 years. Right? But he got to hold two of his grandchildren in his arms, right? He did not get to see his daughter's graduation, but I think all that's good. And it's true that my cousin, he comes from a more conservative family. We don't all vote for the same people. And one of the weird things, I'm going to say this, this is a weird thing that happens. When people know that you've been an organ donor, they're judging you. But I actually think they're kind of judging themselves too. Mm-hmm. And every time I see George's widow, she comes up to me and she said the same thing for 20 years. Lisa, I would have never done what you did.
Oh my gosh.
But thanks. I know. I was like, so there's a lot of emotional baggage, a lot. And I want to follow that up and say, through all of the years, there have been people who told me I would never do what you did. Mm-hmm. And I'm always rude to those people. I'm right in their face. See, I almost just had to hit the dump button because I almost was a little too honest about what I say to people. But seriously, when you unequivocally have the opportunity to save someone's life, mm-hmm. really, we don't get that opportunity very much. Mm-hmm. We don't. Mm-hmm. And even with my scar and all of the everything that I had from the surgery, it's one of the things I'm most proud of. Mm-hmm. My friend Lenita Duke, who's also on these airwaves, Lenita Duke, she's the one who took me aside and said, you're taking your kids with you because I want them to see what you went through. And she told me everything about how I was going to do it. And she was right. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening now, don't go to people that are organ donors and tell them that you would have never done that. Just don't do it. Skip that step. Mm-hmm. Because actually, you may. Mm-hmm. You might, actually. And it depends on who the person is and what the situation is. Mm-hmm. Seriously. We are talking with Jackie Wirz from, she's the executive director of Donate Northwest. I'm Lisa Loving. You're listening to Keeping It Real. And we're keeping it super real today because we're talking about organ donation. And you should, you know, I just want people to be real about what are we here on this planet for. Mm-hmm. And I get that a lot of people probably don't feel comfortable going into our healthcare system. It's not the best. Mm-hmm. There's certain things we do really, really well. But I want to ask you a few more questions about that, mm-hmm. Jackie.
Yeah.
Like, as a donor, how much money do I have to pay? Do I have to pay for that?
No. So when you sign up to be a donor, the costs of that are generally covered by your insurance. And then additionally, being a donor is covered in the state of Oregon by the Oregon Family Leave project that is just launching in applications starting in August, and you can start taking the leave as soon as September. So this means that you are able to donate and then you will not receive a loss of income during the recovery period, as it is considered a altruistic healthcare act.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't have that benefit. I just happened to be between jobs. Yeah. But I didn't have to pay for my surgery was in Minnesota. It was at the Mayo Clinic. It was my cousin's insurance that paid for everything, yeah. actually. But he also, and this is another thing that we haven't talked about. Where does the money come from? My cousin fundraised for his own health for many years. Mm-hmm. He probably called 1,000 people mm-hmm. on the phone, asking them either to make a contribution to his fund to pay for the surgery, or to ask other people to get tested to see if they would maybe do it. And but you guys, Donate Life Northwest, do some of that. He didn't have you guys. Mm-hmm. You actually help people make up for these gaps, like the issues that they're having.
Yeah, so we don't provide direct financial funds to individuals because that is something that we are not set up to do. But we do provide classes for individuals on how they can prepare to prepare themselves and their family for donation or transplantation and what that is going to look like. Now, we're looking at this not only from a purely medical standpoint, but also a fiscal standpoint, a family standpoint, a how do I communicate about this to others? If I'm looking for a donor, what are some of the best practices for getting that message out there? So we provide training for those different scenarios to help individuals navigate this complex landscape. Another thing that we do is we try and connect people together. So if you're on the list for a liver, that's a relatively small population in the state of Oregon that has been through that similar experience, but we can help connect you to other people that have either been a living donor or have been a recipient and make sure that you know that you're not alone in this particular medical struggle and that there is always miracles possible every day. The thing about being a living donor is that you get to be ordinarily extraordinary just by being.
Right, right. You can have stinky feet. Listen, I'm chubby, okay? I love ice cream, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. I love that. It gave me an excuse to value myself differently.
Yeah. And, you know, 4 years is a long time. That's a lot of life. Think of what's happened in the last 4 years of your life. And now imagine if that wasn't possible. That's a long time. Every single day that someone who has received an organ is able to exist and to make a difference in the world, that is a precious day. And we have that gift intrinsically within us. If I donate, if I'm able to successfully donate a portion of my liver is going to grow back. And I am going to have a fully functional liver, and I will drink a toast to that. But I will have given the opportunity to save this individual's life. And I'm not a physician. I have a PhD in biochemistry. I purposely went that route so I didn't have to save people's lives. But now I have the opportunity to do that. And you don't get to do that every day.
No, especially, and here's another thing, and I'm going to hammer this one again. When I was in the hospital, there was a man who got a lung transplant. He was probably mm-hmm. about 75 years old, mm-hmm. and now he was receiving a lung. I wonder if you can help me, like, just do something with this wrong idea, but that there's like a judgment that, well, if somebody's so old, they shouldn't get that. They're too old. Like, how do we even decide who, quote, deserves, unquote, to get these body parts. Like, you've heard that before too. Like, we'll hear people, and that was my first thought too,
yeah,
when I was in the hospital. My God, yeah, but that guy's 75. What's he going to do with that lung? He probably lived another 10 years, to be honest. But talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So this is one reason why the conversation about how the matching system is set up is so incredibly complex, because there's the medical need and the medical outcomes. And these medical outcomes include, like, how long is this individual expected to live with a successful transplant versus how long they will live without a successful transplant? That's part of those calculations. But what really is a conversation is the ethics behind it all. And ethically, we need to give people a chance at life regardless of age, of gender, of sexual orientation,
race,
And one of the things that's I've always loved about organ, eye, and tissue donation is that it does not matter if you are LGBTQIA+. So for years, you couldn't donate blood to the Red Cross if you were a homosexual male, or if you had traveled to Thailand or had a tattoo. Like, these are things.
We were in the military too.
Yeah. I mean, this is just wrong. And in 2018, the HOPE app was passed that allows HIV positive individuals to donate organs to HIV positive individuals. And this just makes so much sense. And we want people to live their best lives possible, no matter what that life may look like. And the judgment that we all intrinsically have, we all have our own biases as we thinking about what life means. But this is why that national system exists. They have ethicists that weigh in. This is why the algorithm is complex and more nuanced than just saying, oh, you're O-positive blood and O-positive blood. It's a much more complex calculation because we are trying to value all aspects of life.
If you just tuned in, we're talking with Jackie Wirtz. She's the executive director of Donate Northwest. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We are keeping it real. We're talking about kidney donation. We're talking about organ donation. And of course, you can donate blood too. If you've listened to me, you know I'm a regular blood donor too. Different organization. And they've gone through some interesting changes too at the Red Cross, mm-hmm, places to donate blood. But we're going to have to bring someone from there on the air to talk about that specific thing. Jackie Wirtz, what is your role as the executive director of Donate Northwest? Donate Northwest has been around for how long now?
We have been around for 48 years. I know, it's amazing. And so in 2 years, we're going to be celebrating our 50th anniversary. Now, that's one of the good ones where you're supposed to give gold. So it's much better than the first year anniversary, which I think is paper. So,
ice,
you know,
or something. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. So we're really, really excited because 50 years is a legacy well worth celebrating. But at Donate Life Northwest, as the executive director, I am in charge of making sure that we are meeting our mission and are achieving our vision. Our vision is a world where no one has to wait for a life-saving donation and transplant. So that's our vision. And the way that we go about doing that is that through that education, advocacy, and outreach. And as executive director, I am charged with setting the vision for how we're going to accomplish that as effectively as possible and making sure that I'm doing everything I can to get our name out there so that we can get more registered donors, so that there will be reduced times on that wait list, and so that ultimately we can save lives.
So now, registered donors, who should be a registered donor? Who are you looking for?
Oh, so that's the great thing. Never rule yourself out. So we have people that say, oh, well, you know, I've had cancer in the past. I couldn't possibly.
I smoke too much dope.
I smoke too much weed. Uh-huh, uh-huh. I couldn't possibly. And the answer is always, don't rule yourself out. Like, the thing is that bodies are miraculous, amazing things. And you would go through an independent assessment to see what is healthy enough to donate. There have been donors that have been, you know, over 80 to just newborn infants. And that is so true. Like, you can, don't rule yourself out. So anybody can be a donor. And if it's not for whole organs, it could be for eye or tissue. And when it comes to tissue, there are so many different types of tissues. People don't think about this, but like if you've had an ACL repair, there's a chance that it was a donated ACL that was used in that
repair. What's an ACL?
It is the ligament in one of the ligaments in your knee.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So common basketball injuries to tear an ACL. And, you know, sometimes it's a donated tendon that's used. You can donate skin for skin grafts. You can donate aortas. You can donate nerves. You can donate all sorts of different parts of the human body. And these are used in procedures all the time. If you've had certain types of dental surgery, there has been a particular type of ground bone that's used to stabilize dental surgery. That is donated tissue. Mm-hmm. So there are so many different uses, and a large percentage of people have actually already been the beneficiaries of donation. They just may not realize it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So at Donate Life Northwest, what is your biggest obstacle that you're trying to overcome?
The biggest obstacle really is the fear of donation and having this difficult conversation. People oftentimes associate donation and transplantation with death. And this is something, particularly in America, we're not really good about having discussions about end of life or end of life wishes. But in reality, we like to think of donation as a conversation about health. It's a health conversation. You can be a living donor. It's not a conversation about death at all. It's about how you can give the gift of living. And if you're talking about donor as a deceased donor, it is something that does happen at death, but in reality, it is about community health, about being able to give that gift of life, sight, and health to somebody to help enhance the overall well-being of our community. So the conversation really shouldn't be one that is fearful or depressing. It should be an informed conversation where we're talking about that a single donor can save or enhance up to 125 lives, that a single donor is able to really make a difference to a whole community. Like if Bobby Beltran, that is not just his family, but several families who have really come together over that generous act. So this is a conversation that we just encourage people to have. I'm not even saying go forth and register. I'm saying have a conversation. That's my greatest goal, is to have a conversation. And the greatest difficulty is that it's difficult for people to initiate.
And yet, it has made for some awkward moments at cocktail parties, for real. But again, I keep going back to all the healthcare workers, all the different, totally different kinds of healthcare workers at the hospital when mm-hmm. I was getting all my tests, who giggled. And they just thought it was so funny. Like, it was amazing that somebody was there who didn't even need to be there. That was their attitude. Mm-hmm. You don't even need to be here. Thank you for being here. It was amazing. Yeah. We had talked a little bit earlier about race and racism and how it impacts organ donation system. And you had mentioned this thing that someone very, very recently said to me, that she had registered to get some sort of procedure up in the Seattle area, but that she had to fill out a section that talked about what race she was. And she was asking me, you know, if I'm going to donate something to a Black person, do I have to be a Black person too? Can we go through that one more time? Because to me, mm-hmm. some of the racial aspects, the racial misunderstandings, and in some places just plain old racism, really do. I mean, to me, I see some real issues there with people that I talk to out in the world. So can you just ring that bell really loud?
Yeah. So when it comes to race and donation and transplantation, the reason why racial disparities exist is because of systemic racism. This is a public health issue. Black Americans are not receiving the health care that they need to sometimes avoid certain chronic illnesses that can result in chronic kidney failure, for example. So the conversation starts all the way back with how people can access health care. It is not a question of a Black individual being Black. There is no specific gene for being Black. There is no cranial difference for being Black. There is no difference on many, many different medical levels for being Black. The reason why we talk about racial disparities is because racial communities have been treated differently in such a systemic and deep-seated long way that there are community health outcomes that come with identifying as a Black American, Asian American, Hispanic American. So Black Americans are much more likely to experience that kidney failure, and that has to do with their access to nutrition, to primary care, etc. So when you are signing up to donate, you are not necessarily signing up to donate to a specific race, because that is not what we're talking about here. But if you are signing up to donate and you have B-type blood, so B-type blood is more prevalent in African-American and Asian-American populations. So B-type blood is also the rarer type of blood. So that's one other reason why if you are B-type, then you're probably going to be ending up donating to an African-American or Asian-American population. And there are other kinds of factors like that, that just by the way the populations grow, that sometimes have manifest themselves in some of those molecular markers. But when you boil it all down to how the matches are made, it is about the molecular markers matching up to ensure success.
Jackie, why are you doing this job? What brought you to Donate Life Northwest?
I wanted to do this job specifically because of the inequity in healthcare and health systems. Donation and transplantation, by the time you reach the point of needing a donation, that is the end point in a very long journey, a very long and oftentimes painful healthcare experience. And the act of having a life-saving gift is something that I believe is one of the best things about humanity. So I love being able to see one of the best things about humanity help address and hopefully reverse one of the worst things about humanity in how these racial disparities has manifest themselves in the chronic illnesses of Americans.
You know, I have a lot of different kinds of guests on this show, but this one's close to me because we're talking about people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about, to me, what makes an organ donation important is that there's so many preventable illnesses and deaths in this country we do nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one that we absolutely could do more about it. We just need to motivate and mobilize people,
mm-hmm.
which is a big we just need to do. But I'm running out of questions, Jackie, and I'm just getting to this place where I want, if you had a megaphone to talk to everyone in the world about this issue of organ donation and what is our role,
mm-hmm.
what is our responsibility in trying to make sure that the person next to us is healthy, what would you say?
I would say that everyone can be a hero. It doesn't take exposure to kryptonite. It doesn't take being bitten by the radioactive spider. All it takes is saying yes to being an organ, eye, and tissue donor. You can do this while you're living. You can do this as a gift that lives on after your life has ended. But this is something that we are all capable of doing. And all you need to do is meet one person whose life has been saved by a transplant. And you will know that this is one of the most profound gifts that any human being can give to another. So what I would love the world to know is that you can be a hero, and all it does is require is saying yes.
So Jackie, we've got thousands of people listening right now. They all want to do the thing. Where do they go? Who do they contact?
They go to www.donatelifenw.org/register. It's very quick and easy. It'll take only a couple of minutes. And for those of you who have an organ driver's license or ID card, take that sucker out. Take a look. If it's got a little pink heart on the front and a D on the back, that means that you already have signed up to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor. And I just want to thank you for that generous gift.
All right. Jackie, that's it for our show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. And if you're listening right now, thank you for being here. We've been talking with Jackie Wirtz of Donate Life Northwest. Find them online at,
www.donatelifenw.org.
And you can listen to this show again and again online at kbu.fm. I'm Lisa Loving. This is Keeping It Real. See you next week. Stay tuned. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You know, on a really dark night, even in the North Carolina mountains, you might be able to pick up KBOO, community radio, coming to you from Portland, Oregon. This is SciCon coming to you from Charlotte, North Carolina, supporting community radio, radio that works for all of us.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. The four parts to our plan for rescue are science, policy, education, and communication. We have discussed the status of the first two, along with our suggestions for change in previous editions of World Ocean Radio. We turn now to discussion of the missing links. For any substantive social change, a basic understanding of the problem is essential as access to the full extent of the challenge we face. We need to know what's wrong, to suggest alternatives, to enlist partners, informed allies, to understand, support, and implement solutions. The process, seemingly simple, is complicated by the breadth and depth of the problem. Clearly, a fully informed public is required, and our primary transgenerational tool is education. There is paradox in the confrontation between old and new ideas, vision for past and future. My generation has immersed and benefited from the global expansion of consumption-driven governance and finance. As population increases and natural resources are expended, and the consequences of the status quo are revealed, we, but more importantly, our children, are confronted with the need for rescue. No place on Earth is immune from the climate impact of fossil fuel energy. No one can avoid the heat, drought, extreme weather, and social dismay that has resulted. Despair is unacceptable. Hope without strategy is useless. The critical need is to coalesce around rejection of the enervating conditions and to unite around acceptance of a new social contract that engages, protects, and unites a world population in pursuit of a just and viable future. As the ocean features in every aspect of future change, ocean literacy, driven by educational inclusion and pedagogical focus, is a powerful vector forward. It demands our immediate attention. It recognizes essential principles that the Earth is one big ocean with many features, that the ocean and life in the ocean shape the features of Earth, that the ocean is a major influence on weather and climate, that the ocean makes Earth habitable, that the ocean supports a great diversity of life and ecosystems, that the ocean and humans are inextricably interconnected, and that the ocean is largely unexplored. Ocean literacy enables communication and informs responsible decisions regarding its sustainability and our survivability, now, before we succumb to too little, too late. Ocean literacy asserts the value of nature as part of responsible teaching and learning. It encourages exploration not just through books and studies, but also real-time observation and engagement. Outdoor education, sea experience, place-based learning, these are all new ways of providing access and instruction for young people who constitute the force of generational transfer and value transformation. New alliances are emerging: outdoor classrooms for early childhood, cross-disciplinary teaching in middle and high school, environmental studies majors at colleges across the world, and a new cohort of doctorates, postdocs, professors, and managers who bring a new, broader, sustainability-driven set of skills and values to teaching, planning, and building the new entities of tomorrow. Consider the study of engineering 75 years ago, when focus was primarily on structures, construction design, and large-scale developments, all a functional response of a society commanded by growth. Governance was centralized, regulations and controls were typically a function of obvious abuse. The unexpected outfall of acid, pollutants, and other byproducts of the systems were largely disputed and ignored. When I was young, industrial smog was real and destructive. Today, similar air quality decline is becoming more than a memory or an exceptional state of being. Today, clean water standards and wetland protections are being revised or removed. All that must be reversed. All that must be supplanted by new values, structures, and behaviors. All that must be replaced. We are in great danger of ignoring what we know, denying what we've learned. We risk the abandonment of science, the failure of policy, by failing still with education of ourselves and our children through application and communication. Don't be cajoled or deceived. We still must seek rescue. R for renewal, E for environment, S for society, C for collaboration, U for understanding, and E for engagement. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
You are.